Assyria's cruelly efficient army counted numerous conquests in its history. It was, in the days before the rise of the Babylonian Empire, the scourge of the Middle East. With a justifiably deserved reputation for its often barbaric methods and savage treatment of any who opposed its will, the army of Assyria was the model of terrorism, long before that concept ever gained prominence officially in the world. The shocking crimes by adherents of ISIS or similar terrorist organizations in today's world appear mild when compared to the brutality of the Assyrians. Given such a reputation, it is hardly surprising that most countries that the Assyrians targeted did not even mount a defense. The northern kingdom of Israel, after battling the Syrians, to be distinguished from the Assyrians, the Syrians, periodically over many years, suddenly felt the pressure of a far more intimidating force on their borders. And at first, King Hoshea of Israel agreed that he and his kingdom would become vassals of the Assyrians. The king arranged for the payment of tribute money to the king of Assyria. This was a standard procedure if you didn't want to be wiped out by a force like the Assyrians. But he must not have been happy to be forced into such an arrangement. And as we observed this morning, he engaged in a secret effort to stop paying the tribute. But his secret was discovered by the king of Assyria. He discovered that Hoshea sent an embassy to So, the Pharaoh of Egypt, to ask for his help in combating the Assyrians. It proved to be the last woeful act in the woeful history of the northern kingdom. The Assyrians marched into the land and overwhelmed it with ease, laying siege ultimately to Samaria, the capital, and ultimately reducing it. And then they took all the people and moved them to Assyria. While this was going on in Jerusalem, the young king, Hezekiah, and his advisors received reports of the operations of the Assyrian army in the kingdom to their north, and reports eventually of the fall of that kingdom. If the 10 tribes of Israel could not resist that force, what chance did the kingdom of Judah have with its 2 tribes? Now, before the collapse of the northern kingdom, Hezekiah, upon becoming king of Judah, led a sweeping religious revival. We mentioned that this morning as well. The people of Judah turned away under Hezekiah's leadership from the idolatrous policies of Hezekiah's father and predecessor, the wicked King Ahaz. They returned to the true worship of the Lord at the temple in Jerusalem. And all of the disorders that Ahaz introduced during his reign into the temple, Hezekiah and the priests set about to remove those disorders and to restore the kingdom and the temple. From Hezekiah's fourth year of his reign, and for 2 years afterward, the capital of the northern kingdom was under siege from the forces of Assyria. And finally, it succumbed. And so the buffer that Judah enjoyed between it and the Assyrians disappeared. And once the Assyrians digested the northern kingdom and got their administration set up in it, they set their sights on the southern kingdom as well. And so 8 years after Hezekiah ascended the throne, the dreaded hordes from the north invaded Judah. And we read in chapter 19, just before the portion that we read this evening, we read of the threats that they issued against the kingdom and how they took the fenced cities, the walled cities. Now we read in chapter 18 that Hezekiah initially followed the policy that Hoshea had followed in paying tribute. And for a while that worked out reasonably well, although he had to remove most of the gold and silver from the temple in order to pay the tribute. But it was only for a while. The policy of appeasement was only going to hold up for a while. The Assyrian army eventually assembled around Jerusalem. And when they had cut off all the roads in and out of the city and had a force outside all the gates to the city, the Assyrian army demanded that the city surrender. Now, if you had been in the city of Jerusalem, inside the city's defenses, wall or no wall, the inhabitants of the city had to conclude that theirs was going to be the fate of the previous residents of Samaria in the north. The Assyrians were going to take the place. It seemed that prospects were so bleak as to be inevitable. You would have concluded that. But then, miraculous intervention began to raise the confidence of the people that the city would not fall. In the midst of the siege came the blessed words of the Lord through the prophet Isaiah, and those words carried with them the unmistakable assurance of divine comfort for fearful saints. Divine comfort for fearful saints. The atmosphere of our times has some similarities to the situation that the people of Jerusalem faced at the hands of Sennacherib and his mighty army. The people of God today face a whole array of threats, the latest of which is the effort to compel them to abandon that which they know to be true when it comes to the definition of marriage. It becomes clearer all the time that the present circumstance has little to do with the idea of marriage and everything to do with the effort to eliminate the voice of that which is right and true in society. Saints with some experience have seen a whole series of such developments in their lives. But they may sense that this threat is the greatest one so far. Some of them know that civilizations usually reach their final stages when they embrace sodomy. and campaign against those who resist it. And that knowledge creates a certain level of apprehension, not only about the present time, but about the generations to follow. But if we may find assurance in the reality of divine fury against depraved folly that we considered this morning, we may also find assurance this evening in the reality of divine comfort for fearful saints. The experience of the people under King Hezekiah makes it plain that there is every reason for the people of God to be confident in their God, to be hopeful. As I said this morning, the idea with which we ended, the idea of the shining of mercy, forms the prologue to the message this evening. For again, in our passage this evening, there are four main thoughts. First, a crushing crisis. Now, the situation that led to the passage that we have read did not unfold behind closed doors or in the back channels of coded communications. The challenge to the people of Jerusalem, whether they were in the army or not, was very public. The leader of the Assyrian army, a man named Rabshakeh, displayed his contempt for the defenders of the city. The Assyrians knew nothing of the truth, as became apparent if we look back at chapter 18 in the statements that we find beginning at verse 22. Here is what the Assyrians were saying to the people of Jerusalem. "But if ye say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away, and hath said to Judah and Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem?" They were totally ignorant. Totally ignorant. They heard this news report that Hezekiah had all of the altars to the false gods taken away. And so they said, "Look, isn't the Lord your God, isn't he the one whose altars Hezekiah has removed?" Verse 25, the message continued, "Am I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it? The Lord said to me, go up against this land and destroy it." Well, the Assyrians had done the Lord's bidding in Israel, so they were just using the same justification for this campaign. And then we go down to verse 33, the message directly to the men on the walls. "Hath any of the gods of the nations delivered at all his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and of Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hena, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria out of mine hand? Who are they among all the gods of the countries that have delivered their country out of mine hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of mine hand?" They knew nothing of the truth. They were spouting these religious illusions out of pure ignorance. And then, of course, the Assyrians delivered a letter that was to be taken to Hezekiah to assure him that the city was going to fall, that they could not stop the advance of the Assyrian army. the siege was already underway. Now, if you study warfare in the ancient world, you know that the siege was one of the most common tactics that was employed. There was no air power. There was no other way in which to do war except either by sea or, in this case, by land. And if you had a city that had walls surrounding it, instead of wasting the forces of the attacking army in assaults against the walls, you just set up a ring around the city and prevented anything from going in or out, and waited for all the water and the food supplies within the city to be exhausted. And then, when the people were sufficiently weakened, you launched your assault. So the siege was a very effective device. It nearly always led either to surrender or to devastation. So how would King Hezekiah respond? What would the leaders of the army recommend? Because there seemed to be no way out except for destruction. But here is the situation for the Lord's people in every generation. The forces of the ungodly seem to be overwhelming, and it appears that they must prevail. What will the Lord's people do? How will they manage? Already, since Friday, articles are appearing that argue that now is the time to begin taxing religious institutions of every kind with the chief aim of driving them out of business. It is the crushing crisis. How would Hezekiah respond? How will we respond? Because you see, Hezekiah's response was a little different than what we would have expected. And that brings me to the second thing in the passage, a concerted call. A concerted call. We read that King Hezekiah turned to the Lord. Verse 14, Hezekiah received the letter of the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up into the house of the Lord and spread it before the Lord. The beginning of the chapter, you can read that King Hezekiah heard the threats against the city, and he went into the house of the Lord, and he sent messengers to the prophet Isaiah. And Isaiah sent word back through those messengers not to worry, that the Assyrians were not going to succeed. But this letter was a new development. And the king spread it before the Lord. His prayer is an impressive model for us. It's a model of reverence, praise, piety. Notice that in verse 15, he addressed the Lord as the Lord God of Israel, which dwellest between the cherubims. The one dwelling between the cherubims. What was between the cherubims on the Ark of the Covenant? It was the mercy seat. It was the propitiatory place. It was the place where the blood of the atoning sacrifice was sprinkled. That is where God promised to meet with his people. So that Hezekiah was praying on the ground of the atonement, on the ground of the blood. What a model for us to remember that we come to pray before the Lord on the ground of the blood atonement. The call to the Lord, of which we read, was a call, as he acknowledged in verse 15, to the one who has made heaven and earth, to the one who is the sovereign over all the kingdoms of the world, including over the Assyrians. And the call was for the Lord to deliver his people. Notice that in verse 16, Lord, bow down thine ear and hear. Open, Lord, thine eyes and see and hear the words of Sennacherib, which hath sent him to reproach the living God. Now, is there any suggestion here that Hezekiah thought that somehow God was not paying attention? Not at all. And here is why it is not a wrong thing for us to pray, Lord, behold what the ungodly are doing. In verse 19, there was the petition, I beseech thee, save thou us out of his hand. And what was the motivation for this deliverance to be? So that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord God, even thou only. Hezekiah was praying for the deliverance of God's people and to make it plain that the gods of whom the Assyrians spoke were no gods at all. Indeed, they were nothing at all. Here is the response of the people of God in the crushing crisis, calling upon the Lord. Let God arise and cause his enemies to be scattered. Hezekiah was placing himself on God's side. Let the people of God take God's side against the enemies of God. There is a very powerful portion in the 139th Psalm to which I direct your attention. Psalm 139, verse 19. This is from the very same psalm that speaks to us of God's omniscience and God's omnipresence. In verse 19 we read, surely thou wilt slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, ye bloody men. For they speak against thee wickedly, and thine enemies take thy name in vain. Do not I hate them, O Lord, that hate thee? And am not I grieved with those that rise up against thee? I hate them with perfect hatred. I count them mine enemies. That perfect hatred is the hatred that God has for those who stand against him. It is his settled opposition. David was not saying that he was going to go out and find the enemies of God and cut their heads off. He was saying he was going to stand for God and against the enemies of God. This concerted call then was for deliverance. And notice that there came a direct answer from the Lord. That's the third thing in the passage, a comprehensive cure. A comprehensive cure. For we read that the word came from Isaiah the son of Amoz, beginning in verse 20. And what a word it is. That is, here was Isaiah. He was not there where Hezekiah was praying. Hezekiah was in the house of the Lord, or in the king's house. Isaiah was not there, but Isaiah sent a message to Hezekiah. And this was the message. Thus saith the Lord, that which thou hast prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria. Notice the specific nature of this message. I have heard. That's a wonderful encouragement. When Hezekiah prayed, immediately a message came to him from the prophet Isaiah. That which thou hast prayed, I have heard. Doesn't the devil play games with us and get us to doubt whether or not our prayers do any good at all? But here is encouragement that Hezekiah came and prayed to the Lord who dwells between the cherubims, to the maker of heaven and earth. And then came the word, the Lord has heard you, Hezekiah. And the Lord had a message for the Assyrians. We read that message beginning at verse 21. This is the word that the Lord hath spoken concerning him, concerning the king of Assyria. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. Here was the answer to the threat, to the promise to overrun the city. Laughter. We're reminded of the second psalm. Why do the nations rage? And the people imagine a vain thing. The rulers of the earth took counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. And what do we read here? He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. Here was the response. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? That is, Sennacherib's message was not aimed at the people of Jerusalem. It was aimed against the God of heaven. He had spoken against the Holy One of Israel. By the messengers that Sennacherib had sent, he had reproached the Lord. He had boasted about all the things he had done, not recognizing that apart from God's sovereign operation, he couldn't have done one of them. And notice in verse 26, therefore their inhabitants were of small power. Yeah, you want to know why it was so easy for you to overwhelm all these places? It was because I sent you to do it. It was because of that they were dismayed and confounded. But then in verse 27, he said, I know thy abode and thy going out and thy coming in, and notice this, thy rage against me. Here is the real bottom line. Here is the motivation of what's going on in the world around us today. It is rage against God. Let's not make any mistake about it. It has nothing to do with marriage. It has to do with God and the fury of people against Him. The rage against Him. So here was the Lord's word. Because of this rage against him, God would turn him away. And we notice in verse 32, the message continues. Concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come into this city. And to emphasize it, nor shoot an arrow there. Now that was one of the weapons that was in use in that period. He's not going to even shoot one arrow. He's not going to come before it with shield, nor cast a bank against it. That is, they built ramparts against it of earth with which to storm the tops of the walls. He's not going to do that. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith the Lord. For I will defend this city. Here is what the Lord says in the face of the threat. I will defend this city to save it. So that was the message. They were not going to prevail. And every last one of them, every single Assyrian, would be rooted out of the land, and the siege would collapse. We find how it happened beginning in verse 35. And it came to pass that night that the angel of the Lord went out and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. Yes, 185,000. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. That was the end of the siege. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed. All his soldiers were dead. And he went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his son, smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia, and Esarhaddon and his son reigned in his stead. What about Sennacherib's threat now? All his soldiers were dead. He went back home, and while he was worshiping in the house of his own god, his two sons murdered him. It was a comprehensive cure. And that leads me to the last thing in the passage, a compelling covenant. Here we come to verses 30 and 31 of chapter 19. The remnant that is escaped of the house of Judah shall yet again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and they that escape out of Mount Zion, the zeal of the Lord of hosts shall do this. The people from all over the kingdom had retreated within the boundaries of the city of Jerusalem for protection. And while the siege was going on, they could not attend to their fields. But the Lord said to them in verse 29, "Ye shall eat this year such things as grow of themselves, and in the second year that which springeth of the same, and in the third year sow ye and reap and plant vineyards and eat the fruits thereof." That is, from what seemed to be a hopeless situation, they are going to be restored to the place of blessing and provision and prosperity. I think this is a powerful word for the people of God in these days. There is a remnant people. God preserves a remnant people, and they shall not be overwhelmed. They shall bear When you look at what goes on around you, you may reach the conclusion that there's no use in continuing on. But here is the promise, the compelling covenant. The remnant that is escaped of the house of Judah shall yet again take root downward and bear fruit upward. Here is the comfort of God for fearful saints. There is a response to make in the time of crisis, and there is an assurance given to that response that those who campaign against the people of God will come to confusion. Through the centuries, many of the people of God have lost their lives as a result of this campaign, but they have not lost their lives before God. God has preserved them, and he will deliver his people in these days from the hands of the enemies of the truth and the enemies of the Lord. The remnant shall yet again take root downward and bear fruit upward. Let us then rejoice in that comfort tonight, and in the confidence it gives to us for the days ahead.